What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Our guests today are Ronica McCurgy and Carlos Martinez. McCurgy is a family and psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner and acupuncturist. They are currently an assistant professor in Columbia's School of Nursing. Carlos Martinez is an assistant professor in the Department of Latin American and Latin Studies and core faculty member of the Global and Community Health Program at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The book that they co-edited and that we will be discussing today is called All This Safety Is Killing Us, Health Justice Beyond Prisons, Police, and Borders, Abolitionist Frameworks and Practices from Clinicians, Organizers, and Incarcerated Activists. Excited to have you all on the show and to have this conversation. I'm actually going to start with y'all. Ronica, and you can start, and then Carlos, you can chime in after. Ronica, what brought you into the healing field, and were you politicized before you got here, or did your experience in the field politicize you?
Yeah, so I was politicized long before I ever went to college. I didn't really go to college until I was 23. And before that time, I had, you know, spent a lot of time in the carceral eye. That's the best way to put that, I think, where I had, you know, lived, especially as a kid, with a lot of scrutiny from police and, you know, school officials. And then when, and that continued into my early 20s. And so I really went into the, you know, just my first year of community college at the age of 23, very much knowing that I was an abolitionist and that I didn't believe in the way that carceral systems impacted not only myself, but the people that I cared about, and also people who I didn't know who were trying to make a better life for themselves by crossing borders. And so, and especially, you know, my work before the age of 23, I did a lot of different things, but one of the things I did was that I taught self-defense for street-involved sex workers. And I saw how much of their fear actually came from the way that they were worried about constant arrest when they were doing what they needed to survive.
Thank you for that. Carlos?
Yeah, I would say similar in some ways to Ronica. I mean, I think I came to health already with, or kind of to the topic of health and in my own research, already politicized and kind of engaged in different kinds of activism for several years before really taking the idea of kind of pursuing a path of focusing on issues of health and research in health kind of seriously. I was for many years kind of involved with various kinds of organizations and organizing groups in the Bay Area. And in particular, I was really involved with a lot of Latin America solidarity work. My family's from El Salvador. So that was always very present for me. I was kind of more involved with doing stuff around Venezuela solidarity work when that was a thing, you know, back, 15, 20 years ago now, I guess, dating myself. I decided to go back to school to pursue a master's of public health degree and then later a PhD in medical anthropology after kind of a lot of that, as I realized that actually health was sort of an interesting way to think about the kind of social and political inequalities that structure our society, right? And that it was a site of intervention as well, that, the health inequalities, the health injustices that we see are an expression of the broader social political inequalities in our society, right? And that's something positive that I learned from, you know, my public health kind of professors. And also there was starting to be sort of some movement around like, how do we think about as public health practitioners or as clinicians to intervene in ways that are not just about treating the individual patient or body, but about actually addressing these larger inequalities. So I think that is kind of what really brought me into the health space and kind of, I guess, eventually led me to doing the kind of work that I do now.
Thank you, Carlos. Quote, in our social media saturated society, it's now taken for granted that police violence is widespread and deadly. Something in me jerked at the phrase taken for granted, though I agree. But I'd love for one of you to talk about what you mean by that.
Yeah, so, you know, I had been someone who had experienced police violence. And, you know, as Carlos is saying, I saw that healthcare systems were a place that people were not getting what they needed, especially when they experienced violence and carceral violence. And what was also true for me is that I didn't want to be an academic in the space. I wanted to be someone who is doing direct service for people who had experienced harm, which was so common and so ubiquitous and is still, but we actually don't really have the mechanisms to create data around this anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's what's particularly troubling about the new administration and their policies is things like the weekly morbidity and mortality report, which, you know, not every place in this country opted into reporting violence that happened either by police or within holding cells. But the people that did are no longer reporting at all. So we have pretty much no data about what's happening in terms of police violence in this country. And that's what's really weird about it, is that we all know it's possible if we are brown and black people, if we're queer and trans people, if we're disabled. And yet if we are immigrants, and yet it's sort of normalized that you are going to walk around and see these people who can take away your freedom and or hurt you. And that's, I think, how most people think about police.
Agreed. And I say a lot, and maybe Carlos, you want to respond after I say this, I say a lot that APTP was born out of the rejection that we have to accept that because we are Black, Brown, Indigenous, Queer, Disabled, et cetera, that then police violence is just police terror, excuse me, is just a part of our daily lives. And then the impact that that has on our mental, emotional, spiritual health.
Yeah, I think, you know, what we're trying to do in with our book is also kind of critically interrogate the idea of safety as it's often discussed, right, in our society. And in our politics as inherently having to be a form of safety that is carceral, that is promoted through policing and more incarceration and really more of the same that we've been hearing now for decades, right? And especially in the last several years where we've been sort of hearing about the idea of a resurgent crime wave that was supposedly produced because of resistance to policing, which we know is just really propaganda, right? I think, you know, with our work, and I think from our perspective from a health lens, we can really begin to critically think about the ways that policing, incarceration, borders, all these things are really, really negative for our health in so many ways that most people are unaware of, right? So we know about police shootings. Those things are very real and sort of well understood, I think, by many of us. But there are so many other ways that these things are actually, that these forms of supposed safety are not just ineffectual, but actually actively harmful for the broad population of the United States and beyond.
Could I add something, Kat?
You can.
Yeah. So, and I think that there's this idea that police used to protect us and now they don't. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so particularly ironic. And also how healthcare systems have sort of made it easier for police to only protect the interests of the wealthy and the white. So we see this in terms of diagnoses, like drapetomania, which was basically that enslaved people did not believe that they should be enslaved, and somehow that was being crazy. And we see that police have been unsafe since their very origins in this country with slave patrols, so-called slave patrols, night watches, and, you know, in the Northeast, particularly in New York, these like police acting as quote-unquote slave catchers. And so we have not only codified it from a medical standpoint, but we've also systematized that some people's bodies are to be treated as if they are transportable and, you know, more in need of being incarcerated.
I and others say often that we parse out the pillars of the carceral state, right? And sometimes to our detriment. And what I mean by that is, say you've got an org like mine that's mostly focused on the violence of local policing. And then you've got orgs like CURB, mostly focused on prisons. And then you've got orgs like Mujeres Unidas, focused on the violence of immigration and immigration control. One of the things I really appreciated from Jump about this book is that you bring them all together. It's like a three-legged stool that a comprehensive analysis can be placed on top of. How'd y'all get to that choice?
It feels like a very obvious choice to me, and I think Carlos as well. When Carlos and I met in Tijuana, working in refugee care and running a refugee clinic on the border, it was so obvious that the people who are deported are the brothers and sisters and siblings of the people who are considered refugees, right? And so it's really about whether or not at that time, they made it across their border, were undetected, and found a lawyer in time or not for many people, right? So that is just kind of an extension of what happens with police, and obviously an extension, you know, prisons are an extension of what's happening often with policing. And then those prisons are used as ways to, you know, further systematize the health disparities that are happening for most people, right? We know that in prisons, it's the only place that we see Black and white health disparities be muted, right? Because everyone's in the same place and they're getting access to the same things. But before and after prison, those health disparities between Black and white populations is great. And we also know that it's not just about prisons. We know that mortality rates for people who are on parole or on probation are actually even higher than for people who are in jails and state prisons. So, yeah, I think that's a start.
Carlos, anything you'd like to add there?
Yeah. So very clearly, these systems of policing prisons, borders are deeply intertwined in so many obvious and logistical ways, and literally through the funding mechanisms and their corporate ties to each other. They're really inseparable, right? Once you take a pretty, a close look at the ways that they operate and are really necessary for each other, right? So ICE transferring migrants, immigrants who, from prisons to detention centers, is none of this would be possible without the massive amounts of funding that are provided for the Department of Homeland Security on the one hand, and for the prison systems on the other. And they're clearly interlinked in the fact that they're all highly racialized in who they're targeting, right? And that's no accident. And I think that's even more obvious now under this maybe current administration in some very obvious ways, right? Where we see asylum completely, the asylum system completely terminated, essentially, except for white South Africans, right? We really can't talk about one of these systems without talking about the other.
Yeah, wholeheartedly agree. And it was just really thrilled to see the way that you all have done that. You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. We're in conversation with Ronica Pakerji and Carlos Martinez. Their book that they co-edited is called All This Safety is Killing Us, Health, Justice Beyond Prisons, Police, and Borders. You all have touched on this a bit already, but I'm going to ask the question explicitly. Please lay out for us the way in which the medical industrial complex collides with the prison industrial complex and either exacerbates the violence of the carceral state and or adds its own special brand of violence into the mix. A couple of things you bring up in the book are things like medical sites as places of incarceration, prisons as sites of medical experimentation. You don't have to go there. I'm just giving you an example of sort of what I'm looking for.
Yeah. So one thing that is pretty clear, having worked within hospitals and clinics for the last 18 years, is that we are not well equipped as healthcare providers to deal with crisis. And we think that when crisis happens, as, you know, practitioners, the only thing we can do is use carceral systems to protect ourselves from that. Right. And that sort of moment of crisis or the moments of crisis that exist aren't ways for us to learn and create systems that don't harm patients and their families. But we see them instead as ways to or reasons that we are unsafe and need more protection from police, which is why, you know, for example, 97% of all hospitals have police forces with guns. Why do we have people, police with guns within our hospital system? I think that is a fundamental question that we should be asking at all times. And if the answer to that is that someone might have a psychotic break and be violent, someone might be in diabetic ketoacidosis and be violent, isn't it our job to figure that out in a way that isn't about involving someone who can take away our patient's freedom? And also, you know, create problems that are for the rest of someone's life because of one of the hardest moments they were having while they were also in crisis. I'll stop there for now.
Yeah, so there are things, you know, in our book, we have countless examples that are put forward by a variety of the writers, contributors to our book who occupy different positions within the health system and the medical system. I think that's what's really a major contribution, I think, that this book really makes, is that it's really the kind of firsthand observations from health practitioners and how systems of incarceration, incarcerality, and policing intersect with the health system. So, for example, one of the chapters is written by someone who was a surgical resident actually at Highland Hospital in Oakland, California, talking about the ways that police presence have such a huge presence in the emergency department trauma bays in Oakland, in Highland Hospital, but also throughout safety net hospitals throughout the country that are often tasked with collecting evidence from patients in ways that actually interfere with the provision of care, right? In that particular chapter, it's written by Mihir Chaudhary. He talks about the ways that he and other surgical residents actually organized to try to find ways to limit the presence of police in Highland Hospital and actually create forms of counter-surveillance that could at least help patients and the people and the healthcare workers be able to better understand what the police were doing in that hospital. But there's a lot of other examples. So we have a chapter written by obstetrician gynecologist talking about the intersection of neonatal care and the family policing system, the kind of arbitrary nature of toxicology screening, and you know, all these ways that racialized, often pregnant mothers are kind of scrutinized in ways that that white mothers aren't, which can often lead to separation from their children. So there are several examples actually in our book that really gets at that question.
And, you know, the other thing that's true is that it is about how the systems operate. I know I'm pointing to specific, you know, clinician activities, but the truth is, having worked in federally qualified health centers, when I have 20 minutes to see a patient and they come in and they are high needs, acting erratic, it makes it difficult to do your job properly and also respond to the crisis. And that's especially true for people with disabilities, right? Like, we know that people with disabilities get poor healthcare, period. And we also know that people with disabilities are disproportionately seen within carceral settings. So, you know, approximately like 15% of people are disabled, but 40% of people within prisons have a disability. So, you know, healthcare also deals with disability like it's a crisis.
You use different words for it in the book, but essentially you say something that I think is so important to this conversation that those of us that do this work are trying to have with broader society. And that is, and again, you say it differently, but that is that one can never achieve peace with violence, right? And that the carceral state is one of the most violent institutions in the world. Mm-hmm. It uses violence to create conditions of violence and then offers up the violence of its paradigm to bring us peace/safety. Mm-hmm. And you also, and I squealed at this sentence, actually, when you said that its greatest power, right, is that it manages to continue to convince us to give it all of our resources without producing the results it proffers that we're paying it for.
Yeah, this is again the power of people are referring to as propaganda, right? Or as the propaganda machine that that has been propelled and invested in very strategically over several decades to force us to, again, you know, equate safety with these systems of confinement and of control. Unfortunately, that's sort of become the taken for granted approach to how we think about safety, to the point that we have to struggle to offer alternatives that are somehow seen as utopian, where in fact, you know, I think, you know, we describe kind of the carceral system as actually being its own form of sort of cynical utopianism, which kind of, you know, it really deludes us into believing that, you know, despite all evidence of the contrary, that we will be made safer simply by investing more and more of our resources, actually pulling resources from the systems that could keep us safe and healthy and funneling them rather into carceral systems. That this is a cynical form of utopian thinking that would have us believe that we can only achieve safety through carceral control, right? And so again, you know, I think we are trying to show the ways that is obviously patently false, but also that all the ways that people are kind of challenging that.
And I do think there's a lot of what we have codified as normal in U.S. civilization that is not true in a lot of other places. For example, Americans have codified the idea that people who butcher our meat, pick our vegetables, process various forms of goods that we need should live in dangerous and cancerous environments. Because that's what we know is true, that migrants who do not have the benefit of documentation are often producing our goods in this country, less now, as we see that these industries are facing huge economic burdens as a result of the new immigration policies. But the truth is that has become this very normalized thing. And we have also codified that police are just going to be more in places where there are Black people and brown people and immigrants, right? And yet we don't think about what the results of that is. You know, for example, that in communities where there is specifically direct and indirect unfair treatment of Black people in the community by police, we see that there's accelerated aging in specifically Black men. And somehow that has become normalized for us. Maybe we don't think about the aging part, but we think about the unjust and unfair treatment as sort of being part and parcel of what we can offer our best efforts at offering equality in this country. And I think there really needs to be a huge shift in that.
Thank you for that. One of the things that I also appreciated about the book is you talked about site-specific impacts of borders on bodies. You also talk about sort of, I mean, I guess I would call it the trickle-down effect or the ripple-out effect. And so I wonder if you could talk about, yes, we know that there are specific ways that prisons, for example, impact people's health. How then do those impacts, I think one of the examples you use in the book, I believe, is asthma. How do those health impacts then contribute to lower health outcomes in the broader communities where folks return to once released?
We know that no one is mentally or physically healthier as a result of incarceration, right? We just know that. And it's something we should feel pretty uncomfortable with. And, you know, we know that translates to cancer. We know that translates to left ventricular hypertrophy, which is like a enlargening of the left side of your heart. We know that that increases the likelihood that there will be interpersonal violence in a community, which affects the whole broad region community. And we know it also affects people's ability to be economically stable. And that affects every single aspect of health, right? Like, people don't get out of prison and easily get a job, because how many jobs, especially low-level jobs, don't have that as a question on their employment questionnaire, right? Most people do ask, do you have a history of incarceration? And if you want a white-collar job, you're definitely going to be asked. And very often there's going to be a check. And that makes it more difficult for people to get housing, which we know is a direct risk factor for, it's the largest risk factor for HIV acquisition. And we also know that people die when they get out of prison as a result of overdose at least 10 times higher than the general population, because there isn't reasonable drug treatment within prisons.
The other way that you all talk about the violence of the carceral state rippling out or trickling down is to our children. I'm wondering if one of you can talk about life outcomes for kids who, as I did, lose a parent to prison or who are kidnapped, let's say, by like the foster care system in the name of safety.
I can. So, you know, we know that lots of Black and brown kids who are diagnosed as having disabilities end up in the foster care to prison pipeline, right? It's something like over half of people within men's prisons have been in foster care. And we also know that, for example, that being trans is increasingly illegal in this country, and that 20% of youth in the juvenile justice system are queer or trans. And so when people experience that institutionalization, that sort of carceral institutionalization, different than just regular old school institutionalization at an early age, it predisposes them to end up in those systems throughout their lifetime. We also know that, for example, lesbian and bisexual women are much more likely to be arrested than straight women. And that's particularly true as kids. That teen lesbian and bisexual women are targeted more by like detention, suspension, and more likely to be arrested within a school environment than their straight counterparts. And anytime you are arrested or in a jail system as a kid, it makes you more likely to end up in those systems later on in life.
Yeah, I'll just add, you know, kind of as a response overall to this question of how the prison industrial complex, how these systems affect our health. Ronica's already pointed to several examples, but, you know, I think what the most important thing I think for people to understand is that these are real sites of, you know, of attrition, of slow violence, of weathering, of a wearing down of racialized, criminalized communities, right? And this shows up in all the different numerous kinds of ways that one could imagine in the form of elevated chronic disease, elevated exposure to infectious disease, elevated forms of trauma, medical violence and abuse are, of course, rife within prison settings. And, you know, we actually have a chapter written by a few folks involved with the California Coalition of Women Prisoners who write in real painstaking detail about the medical violence and neglect that people incarcerated in women's prisons experience, right? And the trauma and abuse that that produces, that that reinforces for people who are actually often entering these spaces already having experienced trauma and abuse, right? So I think that, you know, the kind of message that our book is trying to send is that it's not just the immediate sort of police killing that is harmful, but it's actually policing itself, you know, just simply living in communities where we have more kind of invasive policing practices, actually we know leads to higher rates of high blood pressure, diabetes, and other health issues in those communities, right? So, so yeah, that's, I think, what we're trying to kind of express with this book.
And one thing I want to add is about mandatory reporting. Which mandatory reporting is this type of reporting that healthcare providers are legally mandated, as well as teachers and social workers, many other like professional quote unquote jobs that work with families or children, elderly or people with disabilities. And we are legally obligated to report if we suspect neglect or abuse. And what we know is that people do not suspect correctly. They suspect in a racialized manner, and they suspect in a manner that is very much about whether or not the family in front of them is poor or not. And, you know, after mandatory reporting, it's not like survivors do better. 82% of people who've had mandated reports made about them either don't do better at all, like nothing changes, or 50% of those people get things get much worse. And for 12% of people, it just gets like a little bit worse, right? So like, we are not doing anything good by putting families within a carceral framework or the eye of systems that can create crucial problems for them.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Ronica Mukherjee and Carlos Martinez. Their book that they co-edited is called All This Safety is Killing Us, Health Justice Beyond Prisons, Police, and Borders. And Ronica, you really transitioned to where I wanted to go next, which is, you know, this tagline of the show is to expose, agitate, and build. And so I want to walk through some of the points related to how we get from here to there. And you jumped to something that I was going to ask about, which is mandatory reporting. So you just talked about all of the problems of mandatory reporting. What do we want clinicians to do instead?
We want clinicians to bring resources to families that are struggling. If you see a parent and you're like, wow, you look like you are not taking care of your kid, it's rarely because the parent doesn't want to take care of their kid. Right? It's almost always because parents need more support. They need childcare. They need financial resources. Maybe they need something to help them teach them how to parent. Not everybody who's a parent knows how to parent, right? I think we're all very aware of that. Right. Exactly. I think it is a skill set that some people recognize as a skill set and choose to engage in learning in, and other people have to be kind of encouraged to do that in a more targeted way. And so instead of reporting people, bring in non-carceral case management and social workers and after school programs. And, you know, there's going to be situations where you're like, this kid cannot be in this home, right? Maybe that's possible, right? Of course. But also the vast majority of what is being reported, it's not appropriate. And it is racialized and it is class-based.
That's right. The other thread I want to tug on here, and I think it's really important, we're in the so-called liberal left Bay Area, we're having a real serious conversation, right, about substance utilization. And so I super appreciated, this point about destigmatization, normalization, and acceptance of underground drug use. You say that this must increase. I would agree. I'm wondering if one of you can talk about why it must increase and why this current crisis, let's say, that we're seeing in our streets is reflective of the fact that we've been doing it wrong, right? We got to the amount of people dropping dead in our streets because we've been doing it wrong, not because we've had more. And in fact, we've seen since DA Brooke Jenkins has implemented sort of this zero tolerance policy for substance utilization, deaths have gone up, people rotting in cells have gone up, use has not gone down.
So we have a few kind of chapters that address this question of substance use and really how to rethink, as you said, kind of our approach to it, right? And that approach that is harm reduction, right? And harm reduction efforts are that have, you know, just incredible amounts of evidence behind their efficacy at this point, which unfortunately doesn't get taken seriously within the political realm as much as it should, right? And in some places it has, certainly, but even here in sort of the liberal California where I'm situated, where you're situated, Kat, there's been, unfortunately, severe pushback against harm reduction, right? And I would argue that's only because of the ways that it's been conflated with sort of street homelessness, as if one leads to the other, right? As if harm reduction is somehow the culprit for why we have homelessness on our streets, right? And it's become an easy target for kind of the reactionary backlash that we've been seeing. And yet we know that harm reduction is really the only evidence-based practice. It is not abstinence-based practice that is capable of really reducing overdose rates, of really providing genuine forms of care for people who are engaged in substance use, who, you know, are often being forced into things like, kind of abstinence-based drug treatment, or are having their kind of harm reduction supplies taken from them from police, all these things that we know actually increase overdose rates, right? And the only reason we're seeing, I think, a national level decrease in overdose rates in recent, you know, kind of now, I think is largely due to some of these efforts in making access to things like naloxone much easier. And unfortunately, we're seeing, of course, a rewinding of that now at the federal level, so which is very dangerous.
And we also know that the drug war is one of the major reasons that people are in prison, right? Like, thank you, Nancy Reagan. Like, just say no.
Just say no.
One of the most useless campaigns in the entire world, universe. I think we can go that far. But at least 38 states in this country allow for involuntary commitment for substance use treatment. And in lots of cases, people are actually sent to prisons and jails, which are inappropriate places for treatment, right? And we also know that if someone's having some sort of substance use crisis on the street, that a lot of the times people call 911, it's police showing up. Are police good at treating substance use when they show up and understanding that this person who is acting erratically is actually experiencing something as a result of substance use and treating it appropriately without increasing carceral harm? You know, I directed an opioid overuse prevention program within a syringe exchange for 4 years, and I just have seen pretty much all of my patients in that come in and out of jail, right? Because they are constantly exposed to environments where that's possible. And that means that they're detoxing in jail. And when people are detoxing in jail, they're not coming out and being like, well, now I'm detoxed, guess I won't use again. That is not what happens, right? They're much more likely to use the same amount that they were using before they detoxed, which is much more likely to produce harm and overdose and or death.
Transitioning a bit, because I just have a few minutes left with you all. And I, as an artist, don't want to leave out that piece. You have amazing artwork throughout the book. Broadly, because we don't have time to get into, you know, the bios of each one, just like we didn't get to talk about the amazing folks that you have interviews with in this book. People will just have to pick up the book. Broadly, who are the artists and why the decision to include art as a core piece of the book?
Yeah, so it feels impossible to move culture forward without art. And as somebody who is, sure, I read, but like, it's not my favorite thing to do in the world. And I love to read comic books. Mm. It's nice for me to think that we are putting accessible forms of learning into the book, because not everyone's going to read these 20-page chapters and enjoy them. And the artists we chose came from really diverse backgrounds. There's a good amount of artists who are currently incarcerated, one of whom died in incarceration, Edie Alina Davis. They're queer and trans artists who are living in various prisons and, yeah, various prisons throughout this country. And then we had acupuncturists and physical therapists who were also artists create art. And we had, you know, people who have just long done political art in community also do art. And we got various connections through Juliet McMillan, as well as ABO Comics, which is an organization I recommend everyone check out. They work specifically with queer and trans prisoners and their art.
So one of the things that I'm really excited about right now, and I know it sounds weird to say it in this political moment, right? Like, what are you excited about? I'm excited about what we've been doing for the last 5 years. I'm excited about that we have been, like, your book in this moment makes so much sense, in part because of the work to build alternative systems, to build mutual aid networks, the rejection of the violence of the carceral state and medical industrial complex is the answer to our solutions, right? Like, that is alive and well and bubbling. We need more, absolutely. Part of how we get more, right, is to sort of spread the gospel, which I see this book very much doing. How do you help the movement incorporates this offering into the work a lot of us are doing today?
Well, I'll just say, I think for Ronica and me, this book is fundamentally about building that movement, right? And actually trying to share lessons from people who have been in the trenches doing this work or impacted by these systems, and really trying to develop new comrades, right, within the health space, which we need, we desperately need, right? And that, as we explain, I think, at the beginning of the book, healthcare, health justice requires abolition, and the abolitionist movement also requires the involvement of health practitioners at all different levels, right? We won't achieve, I think, the abolitionist futures that we want without their involvement, in large part because our carceral systems are so heavily embedded within and entangled within our health systems, right? It's not because health people in the health space are special in any way. It's simply because we're already so implicated within carcerality in these carceral systems. So we have to become, comrades to the organizations that have been doing this work for a long time. And I think that's what we're hoping to achieve with this book, to bring people into the movement, to show that this work has been getting done for actually a long time, and really just trying to bring that to light and kind of motivate people, despite the kind of national political conditions that we're all living in right now, that there is still space to move, right? And there are still actions and activities that we can take from the bottom up to do that work.
And I would argue we, not just space, but that's the mandate, right? People are like, well, what do we do? This is what we do, right? This is a big piece of what we do. Ronica, I'm gonna offer you last words before I have to say goodbye to y'all.
Sure. I mean, for clinicians and clinical settings, I think this means no policing our patients, right? And this includes not only whether or not they're using substances or we think they're doing something illegal, but this includes not policing them, taking the cop out of our heads when we're seeing patients and they're not taking the medications we wanted them to take or doing the interventions that we wanted them to do. And that abolitionist health justice also means believing that this person in front of you was detained or imprisoned for something that a richer person would have gotten away with, and understanding that, because that is what believing in marginalized communities means, is seeing contexts.
All right, family, you are listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, and we've been in conversation with Ronica McCarjee and Carlos Martinez. Their book that they co-edited is called All This Safety is Killing Us, Health Justice Beyond Prisons, Police, and Borders, Abolitionist Frameworks and Practices from Clinicians, Organizers, and Incarcerated Activists. Ronica McCarjee is a family and psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner and an acupuncturist. They are currently an assistant professor in Columbia School of Nursing. Carlos Martinez is an assistant professor in the Department of Latin American and Latin Studies and core faculty member of the Global and Community Health Program at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Kat.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.